That magnificent voice and distinctive artistry belongs to none other than Jesse Norman, one of the most splendid, most acclaimed, most recognizable singers of her generation. She has sung with great distinction on just about every major opera and concert stage around the globe, called upon to sing for some of the most important events of her time, including two different presidential inaugurations, the ceremony for which President Jimmy Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize, and many other important occasions. A recipient of the Kennedy Center Honors, the National Medal of the Arts, 5 Grammy Awards, amongst many other honors and awards too numerous to mention here. And now she is also the writer of a beautifully crafted, deeply meaningful memoir titled Stand Up Straight and Sing, which is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, which recounts many events, although by no means all, of the memorable events in her extraordinary life and career. And I am deeply honored to be able to spend the next few minutes speaking with Jesse Norman about her life and career and her beautifully written memoir, again titled Stand Up Straight and Sing. Jesse Norman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you so much. Miss Norman, I've had the pleasure of experiencing your singing several times in person, and of course many, many times beyond that on television and on recordings and so on. Specifically in person, I had the pleasure of seeing you at the Lyric Opera of Chicago in the title role of Gluck's Alceste, and
Yes. And
twice at the Ravinia Festival. One concert featured, a portion of Samson and Delilah, and actually the first time I saw you at Ravinia was from the front row center, where I saw you in Act One of Wagner's Die Walküre in the role of Sieglinde. I want to ask you a little bit about that, what was a memorable night for all of us who were there. But first, for the sake of our listeners who were not so fortunate, I want to play just a little bit of the recording of Der Männersippe from Act One of Die Walküre. And conducting this Deutsche Grammophon recording as he conducted that performance that night at Ravinia, the great James Levine. So here is the voice of Miss Jesse Norman. I can't get over the thrilling sounds that you made, and it brings me back to that memorable night at Ravinia. And I remember telling friends of mine, as I tried to describe it, I felt like I was taking a bath in the sound of a singer. I'd never experienced that before. It was just incredible.
Thank you.
I wonder for you, who, mm-hmm. of course, heard yourself sing all your life and, of course, know all these recordings inside out, I should think. For you, is it possible for you to be thrilled by the sound the same way that we are in the public who listen to these recordings, or do you know your voice too well to react to it in that kind of way?
I think it would be quite impossible for a performer to react in the same way that an audience would from any kind of performance, whether it's from dancing or playing the piano or the violin or singing, because we know what we intended to do at every point. On every syllable, and sometimes that's exactly what we wanted, sometimes it wasn't, so one is more concerned and I think more thoughtful about the performance itself rather than just relaxing and being able to enjoy it as a performance, because it's simply too personal. And I don't think that it's possible to be really objective. I might be wrong in that as far as other people are concerned, but certainly in my experience, I find that I'm so busy listening to, gosh, I would have done that differently. and so I'm not terribly sort of relaxed when I'm listening to myself.
Right. I can understand. Well, I thoroughly loved your book. And I am so glad that you were intent on writing something other than the more typical, and then I sang this at that opera house memoir that a lot of singers, of course, have given us. Obviously wanted this book to be something different. Tell us just a little bit about how it actually took shape, how you put this book together, and with what intent.
Well, my intent was to give the history, actually, of an American family, and particularly in an American situation, the time of the civil rights movement in the 60s, I wanted to talk about that in a different way. We've heard, of course, from all of the great icons of the past who were involved in this movement and what they did and how it changed, actually, the history of our country. But these small stories about individual families, we don't hear quite enough about that.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to speak to the idea of being involved in the movement, but at the same time being able to grow up in a loving, wonderful, supportive community so that one understood one's own self and had a sense of one's awareness in this world that was not colored by what was happening historically in our country, because there were people around you that told you every day that you were loved, that you were as good as anyone else in God's creation, and that you might have to work a little harder to prove that. But that was simply the way the world was working at the moment, and that we needed to accept it, but at the same time to know that you could do anything that you set your mind to do, because that was your birthright. Hmm.
You do tell that story so very, very well. And my understanding is that you wrote this book, you wrote this memoir, without a ghostwriter. Certainly it's only your name on the cover.
Oh, absolutely.
I wonder, were you at all intimidated by the prospect of writing a memoir without the aid of a professional writer?
I wasn't at all intimidated. I started, of course, at the behest of my publisher to try to work with a person that was going to be a collaborator on the book. And soon into the writing of the book, it became very clear to me that the person that was meant to help me in this way, Deneen Milner, who does her name does appear in the acknowledgments, that we had a completely different way of using language. And that whereas I appreciated her being a professional writer, that I had to tell this story in my own way with my own voice. And so it became very clear that I would need someone to help me to arrange the material, and that I would write, and that we would simply make sure that everything that had to do with the same subject was in the same place in the book. But other than that, I decided that whether or not it would be considered the right idea, that I simply had to speak in my own voice.
Hmm. Well, it's a great choice. I'm glad that choice is ultimately the one that was made.
Thank you.
The book, of course, as you've already touched upon, celebrates the community you come from, and especially your wonderful family, and not just your parents and siblings, but other parts of your family tree as well, aunts, uncles, cousins, and especially your grandparents. I love how at one point you write, "It was nourishing on every possible level to be seated at my grandparents' table." I just think that's a beautiful way to put that. But tell us about some of the most important ways in which your family provided you nourishment, and particularly your grandparents.
Well, it was so wonderful to be able to visit my grandparents on their farm, because it was rather different from living in the city, even though I was growing up in what would certainly at the time have been considered a small town. But going to their place where there was, you know, fruit trees and things that growing on the ground, melons and things that you could actually just walk around, I considered it really sort of our little private Garden of Eden, because it was just marvelous, all of the things that were growing that you could actually put on the table and eat. And so most of the things that we had at those marvelous dinners were things that had actually been grown on the farm.
Wow.
And so that was especially nourishing, just to know that that could happen, that there was something other than the A&P from which one could get food, and that it tasted completely differently from the things that one had normally. And so it was just marvelous to be there with them and to see my mother become a daughter when we would go and visit my grandmother. It was a wonderful thing to see, to hear my mother calling somebody else mother. And then to do what she said, and to, "Mother, do you want it like this? And is this all right?" And all the rest of it. I just found it really kind of beautiful to watch. And to be with my cousins and my uncles and my aunts and all the rest of it, it was always great fun. And we always had so much talking to do to catch up with everybody's business since the last time we'd been together. So it was always full of conversation and just full of joy to be together.
You describe yourself more than once in your memoir as a little girl who really wasn't afraid to get involved in what we think of as more boyish kinds of activities and adventures. What was it that attracted you so to the kind of things that your brothers and their friends were doing? And I also wonder what your parents made of this, the fact that you, who were in some ways a typical little girl, also really wanted to sort of blur the lines between what little girls and what little boys do.
Well, I think that I wished to, as you put it, blur the lines, because it seemed to me, and I speak to this in the book, that my brother, Howard, who's 4 years younger than I, that he seemed to have more freedom in his choice of things to do than I, who was older than he, because he happened to be a boy. And I was interested, there were more boys, I think, on our street than girls, and so they were always at the baseball games and the softball games and so on. They seemed to be having so much fun. And they would only invite the girls if they kind of felt like it. And I was always wanting to do what they were doing because they seemed to have so much fun at it. And I think I probably was interested in it because it was something that I was told, well, girls don't do that. And girls don't sort of run and play softball in the street. I mean, you just can't do that. And because I thought, well, why not? That was exactly what I wanted to do, as it was that I wanted to learn to take shop in middle school, then I was interested in taking home economics. I didn't see any point in spending time trying to learn how to cook or to learn how to sew when my mother could tell me that. But there was no one to teach me how to make a table particularly.
I love how that story ends with what I think you describe as sort of the crowning blow, or the greatest indignity of all, when the girls of the home ec class were supposed to serve a meal to the boys from the shop class, which really affronted you in a very serious way.
Oh, it did. It still does.
To this day. In your life, and of course, not just within your childhood, but really through into adulthood, of course, perhaps to some extent even to today, two specters, of course, that have been shadows have been sexism and racism.
Racism, yes.
And of course, you've already touched on the fact that thanks to such a loving family and loving community, you still had an incredibly happy, full childhood, and of course, have gone on to live such a splendid life. But still, this has been a reality, both racism and sexism. I wonder, looking back, which was more frustrating and felt more oppressive to you at the time, or which of those were you more maybe aware of on a daily basis, racism versus sexism?
Well, I would say that I was surely aware of racism before I was aware of sexism, and I was aware of racism at a very young age. But sexism was something that I came to understand a bit later, and certainly when I think about it now, I'm not really able easily to separate the two in my mind, because so often they are walking hand in hand, and they still do. And it would be wonderful to say that we've gotten over the racism in our country and in the world, but of course that is not true. And these people that have been writing and speaking about a post-racial atmosphere in our country, I don't know what country they could be speaking about at all, because that certainly is not true here, and it isn't true anywhere else in the world either. And it is unfortunate for all of us that this is the case, but it is simply the truth. And racism and sexism have no place in a civilized society, and they never have. And the people that want to stoke the fires of racism and sexism continually, or simply wrongheaded.
You've touched on the fact already that your parents did such a marvelous job, and for that matter, your whole family, but particularly your parents, such a marvelous job of striking a balance between allowing you to know about the harsh realities of the world, and yet cloaking you and your siblings in this warm assurance that you were loved and that you were capable of great things.
Yes.
Tell us how they managed to do that. I mean, what kinds of things did they say or do that allowed that kind of balance to be achieved?
Yes, well, aside from the general atmosphere in the house, it can sometimes be very difficult to say this is what happened and this was the result. I can only say that somehow my parents rearrange their days and their lives to be at various activities in which we participated as children. Even if we were doing something as simple as I did very often, to sing a song at the school assembly once a week, somehow my parents arrived, you know, minutes before I would sing and would be there while I sang, and then, of course, they had to go back to their work. But somehow they were always there, and I didn't really understand how it is that perhaps a lot of other parents weren't there. I just thought they had jobs where they couldn't leave and that they weren't able to be there for their own children. But my father was the president of the PTA, my mother was the auditor of the church, my father was the superintendent of the Sunday school and the chairman of the trustee board of the church. So they were very involved in what was going on in the community, and therefore we had those icons, our own parents, to watch and to see how one would conduct an adult life. And so that was in its way nourishing and encouraging and certainly educational. But they were, we talk about this a lot, my siblings and I, because they, of course, as I mentioned in my book, they are busy being parents and have always wondered how did our parents really, as you say, strike that balance to be really good parents, but at the same time, which is important for everyone to understand, at the same time, they weren't pushing us. They weren't terrorizing us. They wanted us to do as well as we could, but there wasn't. Somehow they did this without putting pressure on us. We still do not understand exactly how that happened, except that it did happen, and that we were happy to make them happy because it meant so much to them.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today with the marvelous singer Jessie Norman about her memoir called Stand Up Straight and Sing, which has just been published. Ms. Norman, I absolutely love a story that you tell about your mother, an incredibly busy, active woman committed to so many good causes. And in particular, you talk about the work she did to help African Americans register to vote.
Yes.
And you would often be with her at those sessions where people would come and get registered. I think maybe in the lobby, of the narthex of your church, perhaps?
The annex of the church.
Yes, right.
Absolutely, very often.
And you tell a story about something that she would do from time to time. That is, she would periodically ask you to step away and without explanation. And only, I think, many years later did you have the opportunity to ask her why she would sometimes have you step away. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, it was my job to sit with her, and we had 3x5 index cards. Remember 3x5 index cards? On which everybody's name that came to register to vote was printed, was written, and with their address and telephone number and all of that. And that was kind of my little job when people were coming to her table. And from time to time, she would ask me to step away to get something to drink or something like that. And I understood that I was being asked to step away, but I didn't really understand why all the time. And it was certainly years later. I was already at university. And I asked her, you know, why was that? Because I really feel that maybe there was something going on that I wasn't supposed to know or something. And my mother, very quietly, she hardly ever spoke a word of louder than this. And she said it was because a number of the people that were registering to vote had not yet learned to write. And they would have to sign their names with an X, and I would have to, in their presence and with a witness, write their name on the card. And there was no reason for you to see this, because I didn't wish them to be at all embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that kind of behavior was exactly the essence of my mother.
Mm. Such a compassion for other people, and especially wanting to safeguard the dignity of everyone.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's so beautiful.
She was that way. And when I tell the story about it, says anybody that knows her says, yes, of course she would have done that. That would have been exactly the way your mother would have behaved. And I try to learn from her still in my dealings and interactions with people.
Mm. Miss Norman, you write at one point something so intriguing, and I think for me, as you know, a Caucasian from Iowa, this is the kind of a thing that I find especially sort of eye-opening and so intriguing. You write at one point about how many of the great African-American icons of the day, Thurgood Marshall, Rosa Parks, Jackie Robinson, were spoken about in your home almost as though your parents knew them personally. I mean, they were, and there was this sense then that these were not only very familiar names, but vibrant human beings whom you almost knew yourselves. I find that so intriguing. I wonder if you could tell us more about that, and also if that was something that would have been at least somewhat typical in households such as yours in that era, or if that was maybe somewhat unique to the Norman household.
Well, I can't really speak to, you know, what was happening in other households. I can only say that I'm rather sure from the community in which we lived, and certainly communities around this country, there were many families where the importance of the achievements of other African Americans, that these things were brought home to children so that we could understand that these wonderful people were not apart from us, that working hard and dedicating oneself to task could possibly achieve being something like a Paul Robinson, Robinson, or being, you know, if you have athletic ability as well, to becoming something like a Jackie Robinson. And these were things to which one could aspire, but also we were made to feel that these people were a part of us as well. And that was extremely important. I remember my father having a discussion with us about Ralph Bunche and explaining, now Ralph Bunche is in a different political party than we are, but he is a wonderful American and he's an African American and you need to know about him. Hmm. And we would often have discussions. I can remember so many times sitting in our living room while my mother and father would go on and on about somebody that was new to us.
Hmm.
And we would have to take a bit of paper and write the name down so we knew how to spell it and who they were and what they were doing and that these people were achieving whatever it was they were doing and that we needed to know about them and that we needed to understand that they looked just like us.
Wow. In a sense, it's another example of the wonderful gift of balance that your parents
yes.
gave you, as we were talking about earlier. In this case, elevating these people, I mean, giving them their due, appreciating
yes.
their stature, and yet not giving the impression that they were from another planet or another
yes.
galaxy, but
yes.
but they walked on this same earth. And
absolutely.
Hmm. Love that.
And I can see my father and sort of with his right hand sort of pointing to you saying, and you can do this too, and you can do this too, and you really must.
Hmm.
And I don't know, how does the parent do that without making you think, oh my goodness, and making you nervous and worried about yourself rather than thinking, okay, if that's what I have to do, that's what I'm going to do. I don't know how they achieved that. As I said before, somehow they did.
Hmm. One of the things you seem to especially appreciate is how hard your mother worked to ensure that you and your siblings learn to read good and early. You
oh,
think
yes.
maybe by the age of four.
Yes.
And you tell us something really intriguing, that your mother employed rhythm and movement to help
yes.
you and your siblings understand language and
oh.
to learn spelling. Explain what she did and what kind of a difference you think that made in fostering what obviously for you to this very day is a very deep, abiding love of language.
A love of language and a love of this language in particular. And my mother was so dedicated to the idea of books and how they could enrich our lives, that she wanted us to read very early, because of course we were read to as children, you know, before we were able to do it ourselves. But she wanted us to learn to read and to spell correctly. And so she would employ things. There was a cartoon, and it probably was a Disney cartoon, where the word encyclopedia was spelled E-N-C-Y-C-L-O-P-E-D-I-A. And we would have to walk around the house sort of singing that song.
Hmm.
And when she would say, we're going to learn to sing, to spell a word that can sometimes be a little tricky. You don't know how many S's go which way. And she's M-I-S-S-I-P-P-I. M-I-S-S-I-P-P-I. And I still spell Mississippi in this way.
Your mother was a wise, wise woman, wasn't she?
She made it fun. You know, of course, at the time, we didn't know we were being tricked.
Right.
But she made it fun, and we would, you know, skip around the house, you know, sort of spelling encyclopedia. And there was one time, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but there was something called the $64,000 question.
Oh, yes.
On television.
Well, that's a little before my time, but I've seen some clips of it.
You've seen some clips. And at one point, there was a young African-American woman called Gloria something. It's gone out straight in my mind. But she was one of the winners. And I think by then I was certainly at least in middle school. And the word that she spelled, on which she made a lot of money, was anti-establishmentarianism.
Oh, yes.
And, of course, who could understand in middle school what that could possibly mean? But we had to learn to spell it.
Ah.
And my mother sat and she wrote it down. She said, now, when you go to school tomorrow, this is the way it's spelled, and you will have to look up to see what it means. And even though I looked it up, I still did not understand
right,
exactly
yes.
what it meant. Anti-disestablishmentarianism, I mean, for heaven's sake.
Wow. Well,
that's quite a mouthful for
absolutely. Oh, well, it's the sky's the limit when you have a mother that believes in you as deeply as she did.
Yeah.
You write in the book about how you and at least most of your siblings attended segregated schools there in Augusta, Georgia.
Yes.
And you describe it as an experience that was in many ways very much a blessing. I wonder if you could just explain what you are most grateful for when you think about the education that you received in your hometown.
When I think about the education that I received in my hometown, I'd like to offer praise to the teachers that were there, because the schools were segregated. Our two younger siblings went to integrated schools, but the three of us, my brother Howard and my brother Silas and I, went to segregated schools. And the teachers that were there were completely and utterly dedicated to teaching and our learning. And for those of us who showed interest and on whom they could count to do a little extra work, they gave extra work because they knew that you could do it. And this was not to separate you from your peers, but to give you an extra challenge because you were up to it, as it were. And I am so deeply appreciative of the work that they did with us, of the time that they gave with us. How many times did those teachers stay after school with us to help us to work on our, remember, essay papers where you actually had to write 2 or 3 pages about something, which, of course, is hardly ever required of children these days. When I was told that cursive writing was taken out of the public school curricula, I didn't know what to say. I still don't. I mean, what are they thinking? And it was something that was given to you and which you accepted as the norm, that teachers were interested in your own progress. And that is something for which I remain grateful, and I say this about them every opportunity that I have, because they were exceptional.
Mm. I know that one thing very, very near and dear to you is the School for the Arts that is in Augusta, Georgia now and named after you. Tell
yes.
us what your educational namesake is and what it means to you.
Well, this wonderful School for the Arts in Augusta that carries my name is for middle school children who would otherwise not have the opportunity to have private tutoring in the arts. And this is our demographic, and we have over 100 children this year. And we are just beginning to complete, of course, the academic year. They've just had a big thing yesterday with a marvelous new young opera singer who happens to live in Augusta, but she's making a wonderful name for herself. Her name is Leah Partridge, and she happened to have been at the school yesterday working with the children and listening to them sing and singing for them. And apparently it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing for them, and it's marvelous that people within the community are so interested in the school. And the children study writing, and we help them, of course, with their normal school studies as well. There are tutors for that, and they can study group singing and instruments, and we have a pottery wheel, and we have a dance class, and we have a drama class, and we have graphic art. And all of these teachers that are working there are practically working gratis because we don't have a lot of money. And in fact, we need money all the time because we're privately funded. And the children come to us not knowing exactly what's going to happen. And they are so marvelous in the way that they absorb the information that is given to them. And the joy with which they take it gives me joy just watching them.
Hmm.
Just watching them change and grow and develop and to see how far they can go. I mean, we have one young man who came to us as a graphic artist. I mean, he was only about 12 when he started with us, and soon discovered, my goodness, he could dance. And he's taking ballet lessons, and he studied in the summers with the Atlanta Ballet. He even had 2 small roles in the Nutcracker with the Augusta Ballet. I mean, he's going on to realize a dream he didn't even know he had until he started at the school. And this kind of thing just warms my heart just to think about it.
Well, I'm sure.
Yes.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jessie Norman about her marvelous memoir called Stand Up Straight and Sing. Miss Norman, you sang from a very, very early age, sang all the time, but actually did not seriously study solo singing nearly as early as some people who go on to become professional singers.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you have absolutely no regrets whatsoever about that relatively late start to serious vocal study. And in fact, seem to sort of advise other youngsters to also wait. Just say a word about that.
Oh, yes. No, I wasn't a late starter at all. Now, do understand that I started at Howard University with Professor Carolyn Grant. I was 17 years old. And that is a good age, particularly for a female singer, to begin serious training for the voice. And this is a very simple and physiological reason for that. The muscles that we use, that we should use for singing, which of course is in what we will call our stomach area, so that everybody knows what we're talking about, these muscles have to be developed, because these are the muscles that support the voice, not the muscles that are around the lungs or the muscles in our shoulders or the muscles in our necks or our jaws, but the muscles that are around the stomach area. The diaphragm is in that part of the body. And the muscles that are around the lateral muscles in the stomach area and all of these need to be firmly developed before one begins serious vocal training. And this is why I discourage so often parents who come to me and say that my 12-year-old has a beautiful voice and I want her to sing. I said, that's also wonderful. Please have her to take dance. Please have her to take gymnastics so that she strengthens her body. And leave her voice alone until her voice, her body is stronger. Then she will sing for a long time. Or you can have your 12-year-old sing and she'll be finished before she's 20. Because the muscles won't be developed. And you will see, and you've seen this, I'm sure. You wonder why you would look at a singer and you see the jaw shaking. This is because the muscles were not developed and have not been developed and have not been paid attention to in the right way, so that the voice is supported by the muscles that are in the area of our navel, not in the area of our shoulders or in our necks or in our chin. And when we do that incorrectly, unfortunately, ligaments and muscles in the body behave differently. You can practically beat a muscle into submission. You can stretch it. You can make it. You can strain it. You can sprain it. And if you care for it, more than often, it will come back to what it was. But ligaments do not work that way. Once we stretch a ligament in our bodies, whether it's something in our ankles or our vocal cords or whatever, once you stretch a ligament, it very seldom, like a rubber band, it very seldom goes back to where it was. And this is why I try to frighten my young friends who want to study, and it's frightening. I intend to do it. I do it on purpose. Please do not study voice until your body is ready for the rigors of studying voice. And then you will be ready, and then you will sing for as long as you want.
You, of course, are far from alone in as being an opera singer who derived great inspiration from those iconic Metropolitan Opera radio broadcasts on Saturday afternoons.
Yeah.
You talk about that in the book. In fact, I was amused in the fact that you mentioned an opera like Lucia de Lammermoor with Roberta Peters or Matawilda Dobbs.
Yeah.
I can't think of singers who would be more opposite of what you ultimately went on to be, you know, vocally. But nevertheless, of course, great singers in their own Fach. And just say a word about what kind of an inspiration or what kind of effect on you those broadcasts from the Met had.
Well, I talk about those Met broadcasts all the time, because that was my first acquaintance, of course, with opera. And because of the wonderful Milton Cross, the voice of the Metropolitan Opera, who explained everything that was happening on stage, I was not in the least intimidated to listen to the broadcasts, because I wasn't worried about not speaking Italian or French or German or whatever language in which the broadcast was happening that Saturday, because Milton Cross told me exactly what was happening. He told me what the story was about, at which point in the opera. He told us what the singers looked like, what they were wearing, and what the opera house looked like, and how the people were enthusiastic, and the house was full, and all that. And so it was a wonderful thing for the imagination, as well as an education in listening to opera, because one could imagine in one's own mind what it all looked like. And wasn't that exciting? And I would take as much time, as I say in my book, my job on Saturday was to clean my room after a certain age, when I was about sort of 10 or 12 or something. And I would take as long to clean my room as the opera lasted.
even if it wasn't quite that messy.
No, it wasn't. It was a small room. But I would take as long as, it, you know, I'd just sort of fool around in the room until the opera was over.
I know that in addition to those Metropolitan Opera radio broadcasts, you are also very, very grateful for a neighbor who I think you referred to and most referred to as Miss Daisy,
Miss Daisy,
a pastor's wife. And she introduced you to one of the most important artists of the 20th century and an artist with whom you would be indelibly linked.
Yes.
Tell our listeners about Miss Daisy and who she introduced you to.
Yes, Miss Daisy happened to have a machine in her house that played 78s. And I had been given a stack of 78s, these wonderful recordings, and I didn't have a machine at our house. We had a machine that played LPs and 33s, but not 78s. But Miss Daisy had a machine that played 78s. And she welcomed me into her living room to listen to my 78s whenever I wanted to. And one of the first recordings to which I ever listened, sort of sitting on her floor with all of these beautiful thick discs sort of in front of me, was a recording from the 1930s of Marian Anderson singing the Alto Rhapsody. And I was completely, and I can still remember that, I was so completely captivated by, first of all, the sound. And even though I didn't speak a word of German, I understood that what she was singing was somehow important. And it was just marvelous listening to that voice. And as I write, I wasn't at the time acquainted with female voices that would sing in that register. And I thought that, my goodness, this is an amazing person. I need to know more about Miss Marian Anderson. And I set about doing that.
And I believe you read her own autobiography at some point and were greatly inspired by her story.
Very inspired by her story, but also there were parts of her story that dismayed me at the time and still dismay me, that she would have been subjected to racism in the way that she was. It's something that I found the time, you needed to explain that to me really very carefully. I remember going to my parents and to my teacher saying, now this happened to this woman, this person who was singing all over the world for monarchs in Europe and all of this, and she was still made to sit in a ridiculous place within a train, and you would have prisoners of war sitting in the front of the train, and Marian Anderson sitting somewhere else? Is the world completely mad? I'm sure that this was my expression with using other words, but this was certainly my feeling, and it remains my feeling.
Of course.
But I had the pleasure, as I write later on, of being able to actually sit and talk with Marian Anderson. And there was no feeling of hurt or a feeling of revenge or any feeling of being sorry for the things that happened early in her life. It was all an experience, she said. And she would always, even though I wanted to know all about sort of meeting these monarchs and what was it like to sit with the king and have tea and all the rest of it, and she would simply deflect the question and ask me what I was doing. And where had I sung last, and what songs, and all of that. And I was, of course, very taken with her kindness, but at the same time, I was really wanting to have her to please tell me these stories.
Yes, you tell us so much about your impressions of Marian Anderson in at one point saying when you saw her surrounded by a crowd of well-wishers, she showed only patience, the patience that comes from knowing oneself fully.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the
and
most
I can see her just standing, and people are gathering around. Everybody, of course, wants to get there to be first, and she's just very patient and looking and taking as much time with every person as she could. Oh my goodness, what grace!
You end this chapter devoted to Marian Anderson by telling an extraordinary story about the Metropolitan Opera performance of Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos. I'm glad we can talk about this a couple of days after Strauss's 150th birthday, but this is the performance that many of us saw on PBS. I mean, it was being taped that night for PBS and home video with the legendary Marian Anderson in the audience that night, and you knew it. And you tell us her presence in the audience had a distinctly calming effect on you. I could not believe when I read those words, because I think just anybody else would have just been practically paralyzed with fear. It probably says something both about you and about her and about your relationship, that for you, the presence of the legendary Marian Anderson in the audience of the Met that night was calming for you.
It was. It was, you know, as though a parent were sitting in the audience. And you want to dust yourself off and fix your hair and make sure your dress is all right, because you're going to go out and sing for somebody that cares for you, that is on your side for sure. And you want to do your very best. And that's the way I felt. It was actually a matinee. And I was thrilled to know that she was there. And as I say in my book, she was sitting in the parterre, which is directly in front of the stage, and sort of just at our eye level. So she wasn't, you know, so that one wouldn't be able to see her. And it was really calming and wonderful to know that she was there. And I was thrilled.
Mm. Well, that was a magnificent performance you gave, and now I know at least one of the reasons why.
Thank you.
Music of Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos, sung by Jesse Norman. Her new memoir is called Stand Up Straight and Sing, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.